Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up this morning, asthma in Ireland, the recent surge in COVID concern calls to helplines, and advice on how to beat breathlessness. I'll also be joined by Conor Crichton of the Dublin Boys Club and artist Mazer to discuss healthy masculinity. And Andy Ramage of One Year No Beer shares everything he knows about motivation. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it was an up and down week this week on what I now refer to as the Corona coaster. I haven't quite adopted some of the other slang that's arrived. I'm not keen on the Rona, but the Corona coaster spoke to me as a word. And I think the highs and lows are felt by all. Moments of thinking that this is all an absolute gift filled with time to slow down and precious moments to get me off this bloody thing and back to all I know to be normal. But I know it's the same for all. I have ordered masks for the family. They haven't arrived yet, so we haven't quite got to wearing them yet. And I feel a little bit like not wearing them is the last mini revolt I can have against the juggernaut of changing our everyday behaviour. But it seems this is the way we're going, particularly as we begin to mix and mingle more as the restrictions are lifted, all while social distancing, of course. And I'm all for doing what will make the more vulnerable in society feel safer and, of course, stop the spread and all of that. But yeah, it's very different. I also ordered some garden furniture for my parents' back garden. It's nice and large so we can all sit far apart but still sit together. So I hope the weather keeps up for all of that. And I did my first Insta Live last weekend. I was contacted by Leslie Giltinan of Lean with Leslie. Now, she is an absolute powerhouse of a woman from Cork. She is a fitness instructor. She's in unbelievable shape. And in recent weeks, she's moved her business online and she's had over 30,000 people download her workouts since lockdown came about. So I became one of those. I linked up with her from my bedroom. She has a more gorgeous studio type room. Now, I don't know, maybe behind the camera, her family members and couches were all shoved against the wall, but it looked good from where I could see. And we chatted and we burpeed and we worked out and I absolutely loved it, as I have all of the online classes I've been doing over the last few weeks. My bedroom has never seen so much action as it has in recent weeks. Steady. And I have been listening to lots of podcasts. One of my favourite things to do is to cook in the kitchen with a podcast on. And I listened to Louis Theroux with Boy George talking about living in the centre of London during lockdown. He's returned from Australia where he was working on The Voice. So he's renting a flat or an apartment in there. And he said it's crazy to be in Soho with no noise outside the window at the time of interview. And when he goes out to the shop, no one asks for a selfie because of social distancing, which is very different. And I also listened to Tommy Tiernan talk to Sheila Shoiga. And he was talking similarly about how he hopes that when all this passes, that we won't have become afraid of touch, and that often he would be approached by fans or people who want a photograph and you snuggle in close to them, you put the arm around this virtual stranger and it's all good. And when he said, I hope we don't become afraid of touch, it almost brought a tear to my eye because I feel the same. I'd be quite a tactile person. I could get chatting to someone in a queue and I'll say goodbye and I'll touch them on the arm. And of course, that's all gone now. So I hope it comes back too. And there's something about interviews at the moment. I mean, from a presenter or a radio perspective, we would have balked at the idea of Skype and phone interviews only because of sound quality purposes. But it's become the new normal. And I think talking to people from their home, particularly with the time of a lengthy podcast, means you can get some very candid conversations. And so on to the show and some more conversations. Over 380,000 people in Ireland currently have asthma and 890,000 people will have it at some stage in their lifetime. And the Asthma Society of Ireland have reported a huge upsurge in people using their advice line to calm their COVID-related concerns in recent weeks. So what's the advice for now and for every day living with the seemingly common condition? Well, Dermot Nolan is a full-time GP in Tramore, County Waterford. He's the National Clinical Lead for Asthma on behalf of the ICGP and the HSE, and he is on the line now. Hello, Dermot.
Hi, Claire.
Dermot, am I right in saying it's common? I mean, would more people maybe use an inhaler regularly than would have been diagnosed with chronic asthma?
Well, it's we have again the numbers I say are quite startling. We've about 20% of children and about 8% of adults have asthma. So it's a huge, very, very common problem in Ireland. We've the fourth highest rate of asthma in the world after the UK, New Zealand and Australia. So it is one of the most commonest chronic problems we see, and Ireland really suffers with it.
And what is it?
Well, it's a sort of basically a twitchy airway. It's like inflammation of the airway. So it typically presents as sort of a wheeze, cough, dry cough, irritation, particularly maybe late at evening time or at night time after sport, etc. It's sometimes, you know, not perceived by patients. They just think that's their normal, that I cough or I wheeze when I go for a walk or when I play sport or when I wake up at night time. So sometimes patients are not quite aware what it is. But I think there is, thanks to, say, like the Asthma Society, there's increased awareness out there of asthma symptoms. And again, it is a condition that, you know, we don't really know why Ireland suffers so much. I think there's certainly a genetic component, because when Irish people go abroad, we seem to retain the high incidence of asthma in our community. And there's also a sort of environmental component to it. And there is this so-called hygiene hypothesis that we're all too clean. We're also living too clean. And we see that slightly lower rates of asthma in people who are rural or grow up in farming, from farming background. And even it's interesting when you look at Germany, before the unification of Germany and East Germany, typically had quite high levels of dirt and pollution, and yet did low levels of asthma. And after unification, when the pollution fell, their rates of asthma fell. So it's a little bit of an unknown. We know and the other thing in Ireland, we have a sort of a damp, moist climate, which house dust mite, which is endemic in houses in Ireland, love. And that is a factor as well. It's becoming allergic to the house dust mite is one of the factors that causes asthma in our population.
Well, that's something I take comfort in every time I decide I'm not going to clean my house today, that really I'm just helping people across the world to avoid certain conditions. And what advances are being made then in its treatment and its prevention?
Well, again, it's asthma is a totally treatable condition, but we have a problem in Ireland where patients, about 60 to 70% of patients are not controlled with their asthma. That is, they're waking at night time, they're coughing or symptomatic during the day, they can't play sports, and it's interfering with their lifestyle. So, and what they're also using is they're using their blue inhaler. And although the blue inhaler is really useful for emergency situations, for giving you quick relief for your asthma, it's not actually dealing with the underlying pathology. And the underlying pathology is that there's inflammation in your lungs. And you need a brown or a preventer inhaler, an inhaled corticosteroid, to damp it down. And when you're on the inhaled corticosteroids, you should almost never have to use your blue inhaler. But we still have patients puffing on blue inhalers a number of times a day. And really, when we say asthma is controlled, we like that patients are using their blue inhaler less than 3 times per week. So that is, so one blue inhaler, one ordinary canister of salbutamol or a blue inhaler should ideally last you one whole year. But yet we have patients going in, getting multiple times, overusing. And this is where you run into trouble, is that the inflammation is not dealt with. They're just getting slight relief, but they are associated with going into hospital and even, unfortunately, asthma deaths, which is really related to using more and more of your blue inhaler. So the message needs to be that asthma is controllable with a brown or a steroid inhaler. Now, we still have some patients worry about, and parents particularly worried about giving children steroids, but the dose is so small that the side effects of uncontrolled asthma far outweigh the potential risk of any inhaled corticosteroids. So we need the message to go out there. You shouldn't be using your blue inhaler only very infrequently, and if you have asthma, you need to be on a preventer inhaler.
That's very interesting. And what about the whole aspect of COVID-19 then? Because we hear it's a virus that attacks the lungs and asthma is something that's related to the lungs, it understandably has created a lot of concern over the last few weeks for people.
Yeah, I think it has huge stress. And I'd say that generally the COVID and when it really hits is the elderly, as we're aware, and you see in the figures in the papers every day and on the news, whereas asthma is predominantly a disease of younger people. So at present, it looks like that asthma isn't a particular risk factor for COVID, but the question, and a lot of people will ask this very, very, very wisely, say, how do I know if it's an asthma attack or if it's a COVID attack, you know, and it's a very difficult question. I think we have to look at, firstly, you have to look at what is your exposure. So have you been exposed to someone with COVID? That puts you in that risk group. And generally, the COVID presents with a temperature, aches and pains, maybe loss of smell or taste, and occasionally slightly more of a wet cough. And asthma, typically, you do not get the temperature or the aches and pains, but it can be difficult. We know that there are some, what we call asymptomatic, or some children who have COVID with very, very mild symptoms. So we're also wary that it could be COVID, but generally it's not. And we treat them as if it is asthma. But the figures are that, and from looking from around the world and from Italy and from China, is that children and patients with asthma was not a particular risk factor of COVID. But to protect yourself from COVID, your asthma has to be controlled. So that involves, as I said earlier, using your inhaled corticosteroids, but also things like avoiding smoking. We know that's a risk factor for the COVID. Watching weight, exercise, all those type of things help us as live a sort of a healthier lifestyle. And those type of things will protect against COVID.
Well, the Asthma Society asked me to mention also their new beating breathless WhatsApp messaging service, so patients can message a respiratory specialist nurse about all aspects of their asthma management. And you save the WhatsApp nurse support service number. It's 086-059-0132. That's 086-059-0132 to their phones. And you can send your message or support query, and one of the Asthma Society's respiratory specialist nurses will respond as soon as possible. And that's an amazing compliment to their advice line, which is 1-800-44-5464, 1-800-44-5464. And I just think it's really important that you stick to sources of information like this advice line or the hse.ie, rather than getting yourself in a panic via Google. So hopefully there's lots of information from that and from our talk with you. Thank you very much for talking to us today, Dr. Dermot Nolan.
Thank you, Claire.
Coming up after the break, how to master your motivation. Andy Ramage is a former professional athlete who, after injury, cut short his footballing career. He went on to co-create two multi-million dollar city brokerages. He then took a look at his health and his lifestyle, giving up alcohol back in 2013, and he set up 1 year no beer, which he came on this show to talk about last year. So I think it's safe to say from those few lines that this man knows a thing or two about motivation, but he's decided to make that more official. He's studied the topic, now holding a master's in coaching psychology and positive psychology, all associated with motivation, and he plans to continue with a PhD. All this learning and personal experience has been poured into his new book, Let's Do This, How to Use Positive Psychology to Change Your Habits for Life. And Andy Ramage is on the line now. Hello, Andy. How are you?
How are you doing, Claire?
I'm good. Do you feel a pressure with all those qualifications and your book and your experience to be in a constant state of pumped readiness?
Yes. And as you read out that blurb, if you could see me, I'm sort of bright red and smiling at the time. It's almost, I always feel a bit slightly uncomfortable, yeah, that I should be this motivational machine, when in truth I was a million miles away from that. I think that's probably what's hopefully quite interesting in my story. It was a lot of effort to get to where I am today.
So why did you want to go a step further and look under the bonnet of motivation, as it were, and actually study it?
Really, this came from my experience at One You Know Beer, because I found myself at the vanguard of huge motivational change, which is to take a break from alcohol. And what I started to notice was that motivation changed. Yet all the conventional learning around motivation suggested such things as, you know, you write a lovely long list of whys and you connect with your whys. And if they're powerful enough, you'll be forever motivated. And that's just not the case. And when you look at people trying to take a break from alcohol, their whys are normally so powerful. You know, you don't get much more powerful whys than people when they want to take a break from alcohol, yet they were struggling. They were tripping up and stumbling and fumbling. So I just want to go deeper on this. I want to understand the science myself, along with my own research within One You Know Beer, and see if I can help sort of unlock the motivational code. And what I discovered was this: motivation changes. So you have to change with it. Your whys are fantastic to get you started. But then a week or 2 weeks down the line, when we start to run out of that motivational why power, you need to adapt with it. So what you need to do, and what I started to educate people and bring into the system, was you need to start focusing on the wins in the moment of the task that you're actually trying to complete to achieve your goal. For example, around drinking, it was very much, what does not drinking give you in this moment right now? Do you feel more energy? Are your eyes brighter? Are your relationships better? And connecting with those wins in the moment created a new form of motivation that allowed people to reach new levels of success. So that was my reason behind it.
Because that does happen. You could be really motivated to start healthy eating, start running. And then after a while, you start seeing it as tough and you say, oh, do you know what? I don't care. I'm just going to eat the chips and I'm going to lie in the morning and I'm not going to get up and go running. So when does that happen and why does that happen and how do you avoid it?
Well, actually, Strava, the running app that I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, running and cycling app, they actually test their data. So they figured out it was around day 12 or day 14 after the new year, they'd see this big drop off, right? So everyone's excited. They're all going to start running. They're all going to start cycling. They'd get to about day 12 or 14 and then they'd run out of steam. And I think, again, back to what I was just saying a minute ago, I think initially we can get filled with this lovely wave of motivation to start these new things. But then you've got to get into the thick of it, into the battle of it. And I think that's where my book, Let's Do This, is really designed to try and help people get over that sort of slump, keep going by looking at motivation differently. And as I just mentioned, the best way to do that is start to connect with all the reasons why you're enjoying this new activity rather than feeling like it's something you should do. Whilst it's a should, you need willpower. And the problem with willpower, it runs out. So the whole name of the game is to connect with it so actually it becomes something that you want to do. You want to run, you want to cycle, you want to eat well because it's part of who you are. When you get to that place, everything starts to change.
And you say something magical happens around the 28-day mark, which is quite a bit on from the day 12 to 14. You were saying that Strava notices a drop off. And I think we've all been there when we've said, oh, here, to hell with all this hard work. So what happens around the 28-day mark if you keep it positive in your mind and keep thinking about all the benefits you're getting rather than beating yourself over the back with your goal list?
Yeah, and that's a perfect way to frame it. Let's just use alcohol as an example. I think what happens is when we start out, it's something that we feel we need to give up, right? I'm doing those air quotes as we speak, that we're missing out, that everyone else is having fun and we're having to make this big sacrifice. It's something we should do. And I think that's why people find it incredibly difficult to get past that first week or 2 weeks. But what happens when you do the work and you embrace, you know, all the different learning that I talk about very much in the book, is that magically you start getting towards those bigger numbers around 28 days. I mean, we say the magic often happens between 28 and 90 days, but there's a mindset shift. I always say, try saying that after a few drinks. It's almost impossible, right? But there is a mindset shift where you actually realize, oh, I'm not giving anything up here. I'm gaining this litany of advantages. And there's a shift that happens. We call it the magic, where suddenly you get that momentum, that wind in your sails, as it were, to say, oh, actually, I'm quite enjoying this now. I quite like not drinking, or I quite like eating in this way. I quite like moving my body on a daily basis. I quite like meditating. And all of a sudden, it starts to become part of who you are. That's ultimately the magic. And once you get there, then you've got the time to start looking at new and exciting goals.
What about then when you're goal setting? What I thought was interesting in your book, because it's different to what other people say. A lot of people talk about the SMART theory, and SMART is an acronym for, why did I start this? Achievable and realistic. I know the A and the OR in there.
Yeah, it's specific, measurable, attainable, realistic and timed.
Yes. So you say, don't necessarily keep it there. That's too safe. Push yourself outside your comfort zone. Why?
Yeah, I mean, SMART goals, when I researched them, were actually developed, again, for organizations. And what organizations need you to do is achieve things. And I think SMART within the corporate setting makes perfect sense. But within a personal setting, I don't necessarily want to set goals that are realistic and achievable, which basically sound like the same thing. I think they just helped make up that acronym, by the way. But I think you should stretch yourself beyond what you think is capable. But equally, and this is really important, it doesn't mean that you always have to try and climb Everest. Your goals could be as simple as to nurture your relationships with your loved one. And for me, that is way more important than climbing Everest, by the way. But equally, it's great to have something, an anchor into the future. I genuinely believe, through all the research that I've read, from my own experience and hundreds of thousands of people that I've worked with, having a goal to move towards is where meaning, purpose and happiness resides, in that struggle to get there. Therefore, I think we always need goals, big and small.
And I think we forget, I've certainly been guilty of it, of looking at things like personal relationships. We seem to immediately go towards work goals, and then there can be physical goals, and you sort of forget about friends and family goals, or mental health goals. They seem to fall by the wayside a little. And you said something very interesting to me recently about some of the very successful brokers you've worked with who get to 50 and have all this money in the bank, and that was their goal, but it's come at a bit of a cost.
The traditional success formula is broken, and that is, you work extremely hard, you become successful, and then, da-da, you're magically forever happy. That's just not true. You know, as someone that's lived that very formula and reached that very place and realized it wasn't true, I was a 5 out of 10. I think so many people are willing to work hard to, like, reach and struggle to find traditional success, only to leave a litany of disaster behind them. That could be broken bodies, broken minds, broken homes. That's not success. That's just material wealth. That's all it is. And I think too many people, that's been culturally framed as the way to do it, and it's tripping people up and it's holding them back. So I've got a real big mission at the moment. It's called The Office Athlete. I'm actually going to run a course in June, if anyone wants to come and join me, for 12 weeks, all based on these principles of just rewriting the rules of success. And the way we do that is to build this foundation of health and vibrancy, nurture our relationships. Like, I say this to lots of people at the moment. The most important part of my day, I hope she's listening, by the way, is to make my wife a cup of tea in the morning. That's the most important part of my day. That's the most important relationship in my life. That's the most important thing in my life. From that foundation, I then work on my body, work on my mind. From that foundation, then look at all the other things that you're trying to achieve in your life. Because then all those traditional successful things are just a cherry on the top. You're not gambling your whole future on some distant happiness that might never arrive. Be happy now, in the moment. That's so important.
Well, good stuff. Happy wife, happy life. If
exactly.
You have a wife in your life. What about the 6 streams of positivity then that you talk about in the book, the sort of state you need to have yourself in to be ready to take on goals?
Yes. Yeah, so this is coming back to that whole office athlete type of approach, creating this foundation. So when I actually researched motivation, what I started to realize was that many of the most important things that bring us motivation, that bring us happiness, bring us fulfillment, are the things that we overlook on this quest to achieve those shiny goals, whether that's to, you know, change career or run the marathon. And we're trying to do all these lovely things, but ultimately we're ignoring the basic, simple stuff that makes all the difference. For example, the 6 streams are: eat a nutritious diet, move your body on a daily basis, reduce or remove alcohol if that's possible. I know that's difficult at the moment during lockdown for lots of people. Find that quiet time, you know, these things, and nurture connection. These things are so important. But actually, when you read from the great works of literature all the way through to the science of positive psychology, they constantly reaffirm that those things, the simple things, they're the things that actually make you fundamentally happy. So rather than always rush on to the next new thing, what about trying to optimize your sleep, for example, as a first goal? Because if you optimize your sleep, you're much more likely to achieve those traditional goals. If you take a break from alcohol, you'll sleep better. So they all start to feed one another. If you eat a nutritious diet, you've got more energy. If you connect, like, with your loved ones and nurture those relationships, the science is all there. You will perform better. So I'm a big believer in setting up this foundation, because the foundation's super simple. But once you have that in place, everything else is just a cherry on the top, rather than the be all and end all. And I think that's the cultural mistake too many people are making.
What about now, the global pandemic, the Great Depression, which I don't think sounds very great, that we're told is to follow? Does that mean we need to dial down our goals and our motivation? Do you think great things can still be achieved over the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's the opposite. I think now is the time to be on our A game, to be the office athletes that we can be, and do it in the right way. And again, start with that foundation, because the simple things don't cost any money. You know, optimizing sleep, nurturing relationships, like, all of these things are so simple. Work on those first, get yourself into that real foundation, and then let's get out there and make the world a better place. People right now are going to have to rebuild their careers, rebuild their lives, overcome bereavement, right? We are up against it, but we are absolutely capable of turning this around. And what we need are positive, upbeat, energized people. And that comes, in my opinion, from building this foundation of vibrancy.
Well, the book is called Let's Do This, How to Use Positive Psychology to Change Your Habits for Life. Andy Ramage, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Claire. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, what is healthy masculinity? The Dublin Boys Club is a group exploring healthy masculinity. It was set up originally in Berlin and on to LA by Connor Crichton, and it's been brought to Dublin by artist Mazer, who both join me on the line now. Hello, how are you?
How are you?
Hi, good.
I will start with you, Connor, joining us from Berlin. Why were you first compelled to start up this group?
Largely, it was an idea I borrowed from a girlfriend. She had a group of friends and they'd meet once a month and they'd talk about their emotions and they got very personal. And I would kind of look at the football team that I played on and my drinking pals, and I thought, well, we never really go to these levels. And if we do, it's always maybe when we're drunk. So I thought this would be a kind of an interesting experiment to try and gather men together to just talk, to kind of practice real talk and be vulnerable with each other. And that was the basis of it. It began in Berlin. And then as I moved to LA a couple of years ago, I ran one over there. And then when I came back to Dublin, Al suggested that we do one at his studio space in Dublin. And that was the beginning of the Dublin Boys Club.
And how do you sell it to men to come along? What do you say it is?
It's sort of just an opportunity. I don't think we have to hide what we're doing. I think there's enough men have an interest in this. They're just not really sure where to get it. So well, we just sort of always describe it as like a place for real talk and a place for men to practice being vulnerable and to come together to support each other's growth. And that seems to be enough. I mean, I think we're kind of, it's 2020 now. This isn't such a kind of a ridiculous idea. It's just a little bit hard for men to find places where this is happening and structured.
And what about you then, Mazer? When did you get involved and how did you come across it?
Well, yeah, Connor and I are good friends for, I'd say, coming up 14 years now. And then he moved away to Berlin and we stayed loosely in contact, and I'd set up a space in town called Atelier Mazer, and it's primarily my studio / gallery incubator space for all things that I love. And Connor's teaches meditation, and I practice that too. So I think he saw that and sort of looked at an opportunity to work together, and that's always great for two friends to work together, I think. And then extended from that, then, you know, I've got a curious mind when it comes to a lot of this sort of stuff and mental health and the understanding of myself and how that curiosity can almost bring new opportunities and relationships. And that's sort of the premise of, that's where it kickstarted with me anyway, when we're talking about the Berlin Boys Club, we're like, well, let's try that here, sort of see how it goes. And, you know, just started very naturally like that, and gathered a lot of attention quite quickly. So I don't think there's any real need to sell it or sell it to anyone. I think we also know the struggles a lot of people go through, and I think it was quite relatable. So that's where I'm with it now.
It's just really interesting for me to hear that it came from looking at your girlfriend, Connor, and her group of friends, because I know, obviously, I only know the female perspective, and within 2 seconds of the first cup of tea or the first glass of wine, I mean, you are deep in, and it might not even be somebody you know very well. We don't have a problem with talking about all of these kind of things, and I just wouldn't know it any other way.
Yeah, I think what happens, though, is that men, by and large, we're not socialized to be vulnerable in front of each other. And I think you recognize, Claire, with these conversations that you maybe have with your female friends, a lot of it is all about, oh, this happened to me, or I feel uncomfortable about this. And it's about displaying your vulnerability, which is something that a lot of men shy away from because we're afraid to show our weakness. We're afraid to show that we're maybe not capable, or that we're lost, or we're indecisive. And this, I think most men, I'm not overreaching when I say this, but I think most men are dying for an opportunity to be able to kind of take off the mask and be vulnerable with each other. And I think this is sort of something that's sort of been a little bit the bedrock of my friendship with Al over the years, is that we've both kind of been sensitive, sort of very open lads who had these conversations together, but didn't always have them with men in general. So it was kind of to be able to create a structure where we would just, a structure that was basically a place for men to learn how to talk this way and to practice talking this way, was very important just with regards to improving the mental health of the friends around, the male friends around us, and just in general.
Because even to hear you, Al, talk about, you know, how you check in with yourself often and you're really interested in exploring that whole side of things, it's not necessarily something you hear all of the time. And you've spoken in interviews about burnout, about making life changes and putting your mental health first. And do you find that you're a sort of a maverick in this sense, in the way Connor's describing it, that it's not the thing you hear all the time in your circle of friends?
Yeah, you don't. I think the conversations have definitely changed in the last year or two, and how we speak to one another, like in groups and stuff like that, you know, the lad mentality or the banter and stuff like that. I think we've all become a little bit more aware of it, and sort of how can we sort of, we're just all a lot more mindful and respectful of our mental health and looking out for each other, and especially in a time like now, it's, I can really see people reaching out to one another. And so I don't think I'm in any way a maverick or anything like that. I would see myself as someone that's just learned from my experiences, and maybe I think through meditation has given me the ability to sort of step away from it and sort of view, repeat patterns and things that maybe haven't helped my mental health or accountability or forgiveness. All these sort of things sort of come about, and then you're looking at bad habits, you know, that there may be crutches that would sort of facilitate not helping the development of yourself. And it's just all that learning, and then you're engaging. Once you accept that vulnerability and you have it, actually becomes quite liberating, and you sort of seem to find more like-minded people and you share those voices. And so each engagement that we'd have with the Dumb Boys Club, I'm in no way going in as a leader. I'm going in as a novice too, and learning and engaging. And it's terrifying at times, you know, because it's a new thing for me. Like if I think about my relationships with men, they're primarily, and I think I speak for a lot of Irish men, it's around the drink culture quite a lot. Like, and with that, then there's barriers up there, and it's not the real talk. And so when you just remove that, I don't know, it's just there's a lot of self-development in it. And it's a new thing. Like, it's a new thing for me in the last 3 years, and Dublin Boys Club is a new thing in the last year. But I can see the reward in it, you know. When we go for, let's say, a hike and we're all speaking, I'll come down off that hike and I'll meet my girlfriend later that day, and she can see it in me. Like, I'm just, my, like, your love tank is full. I'm full of joy, and I'm trying to understand. I love hiking and stuff like that, but what I realised, my real key for happiness is deep conversations and rewarding conversations. And I get that with these other groups of men, you know, these shared stories that we have.
Yeah, I know things have changed now, obviously, the hikes aren't about, but it's all about human connection, isn't it? And it's all about, and certainly when groups of girls get together and talk, you're giving your example so that other people feel the same, whether it's rowan within your relationship, whether it's body hang-ups, anything at all that's wrecking your head, you get it out there and you realise there's 3 or 4 more people going through the same thing at that table. And that gives you comfort, as well as giving you a little bit of advice or a different perspective on things.
For sure. That's like, you look at depression, you look at, like, a simple essay thing like OCD. I suffered from OCD when I was younger, and I thought there was something wrong in my head. Like, I couldn't understand these repetitive habits that I had all the time, you know. And started me nuts. And then once I learned that it wasn't just me, I wasn't isolated, I wasn't one of those, it was actually a condition. But just, like, it dismantled the whole thing. It just became way more easier to manage and understand it. That's the same as this, like, sharing a conversation that people would have, and being open to, the vulnerable side of a conversation between two men is great. Like, you can really learn a lot from it.
Well, how does the Irish man stack up against the rest of the world then, Conor? I mean, I know it's dangerous to have sweeping generalisations or stereotypes, but what's it like for the modern day Irish man, and does it differ from others in the Western world at the very least?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of, from my experience of just sort of, and you know, just sort of to echo what Al said there, like I'm very much, I wouldn't consider myself a leader of these things. I just feel like I kind of turn the key in the door and let people in and turn the lights on. But in, like, we're all kind of, we're learning together. And I think the one thing that I kind of would recognize is that a lot of us men, we all feel very isolated. And even though we have like huge amounts of friends around us, it's because we don't always get to that place where we can go, here, this is really what's going on with me. So we're carrying kind of a lot of secrets or a lot of unprocessed things with us all the time. And then when we can come to these groups, we're finally, you get a chance to see, oh, this guy who looks big and strong can't sleep at night. God, that's my situation too. Do you know? And we can, you just don't feel so isolated at the end. I think, I mean, that was definitely the catalyst and definitely the inspiration for me in setting these groups up was I would see my partner at the time and she just had this wonderful kind of support crew of friends. And I didn't have that. And I felt very isolated and lonely. Even though like I had football lads and drinking lads and so on, I didn't feel like I could talk to them about, you know, just my anxiety and so on and so forth. So I think like kind of when you look at, I don't know if there's a difference, maybe the Dublin Boys Club is more crack.
You can't beat the Irish humour for sure.
Kind of like, you know, and we're kind of, we're a little bit like, do you know, it's definitely more fun. In some of the other boys clubs are, can be quite serious, but I feel the Dublin Boys Club is definitely the most fun of the ones that I've been involved in.
Because in recent years in feminism, certainly one of the rises or the kickbacks has been against the notion of having it all. And just because as a woman now we can have it all doesn't necessarily mean we have to do it all. And that's a big message that's being put out there, and to avoid burnout. What is the kickback for the modern man, do you think?
I think a big thing is to be allowed to show your weakness. I think we've got this into our head somehow that we can never be weak. And I know that I definitely, you know, as a sort of a, like, used to be a journalist and wrote an awful lot, and you would kind of, you push yourself to do these huge days all the time and work more and more and more, even though these things weren't necessarily making you happy. But you kind of, at least I felt that as a male, this was what I needed to be doing. I needed to be a workaholic. I needed to put my health second. And I think one of the big perhaps learnings from this is that it's okay to be weak. And we chat, we have Zoom meetings together at the boys club. And some of us are just talking about how we're working too much. We can't stop being productive. And how trying to retrain ourselves to actually relax and take a break and not feel that that means we're somehow, we've become demasculated at some level.
Yeah, so I mean, it's fairly similar. It's like a Venn diagram in the same, you know, and we always talk about equality and the differences between men and women, but essentially they're the same human characteristics, aren't they, of vulnerability, of showing that vulnerability. Did you struggle with that at all, Al, because you had so much success on paper, if you will? Were you happy to share your vulnerability publicly? I mean, everybody knows your murals, everybody, you know, sees you doing well. Did you think it would be a bad PR move, if you want in inverted commas, to say these are the real things that are going on in my life and share that personal side?
Yeah, I can safely say I have no strategy like that, a PR plan when it comes to my personal life or my work. I sort of go on instinct and gut and be like, I want to paint that, it feels good to do it. So no, like, you know, you're allowed to be vulnerable and you're allowed to speak, and I nurture those conversations. Remember, you're also allowed a boundary, so you speak about what you want to speak about too. Like, you don't need to, just because you say you're vulnerable, that you have to spill everything out. it's what you're comfortable with and what you'll grow with and learn more and more and more. So from my life, you know, from the background of my work, I was very private in what I did, but you know, over the years my work at times has got quite popular, and certain things I've been involved with are quite popular, like certain movements and things like that. So with that, you're sort of, and it's Ireland, Dublin, everyone knows everyone, you know, so you're going to start noticing people. So it's just, I would just share, I would like, if you're to say I wasn't being open, I was through my murals, like the positive affirmations that I'm writing, they're not to myself, like, you're alive. That's a message about my little cousin who passed away tragically years ago, and it's a note I took to myself when I was coming back from his funeral, and just listened to his best friend speaking at the funeral about him, and he was still alive in the room, and I wrote that to myself and then wrote it on the wall, and just sort of, it's an open message to everyone, and people take ownership of that. So in some way, that was my therapy, and I was doing it for others, and don't be afraid, you know, that was 17 words to his wife, and I saw that newspaper article and I held on to it, and I was having conversations with people out in the street, and I just thought I'd communicate that. So I've been doing it all the time, but then in environments like this with the Dublin Boys Club, yeah, it's more one-on-one personal, and people appreciate, I think, that engagement and that honesty, you know. But as I say, we speak about vulnerability quite a lot, and I think if I'm saying this to, if a man would be listening to this and be like, he's too afraid to open up, it's too far of a step. You don't need to be vulnerable about everything. It's like, whatever, you know, stepping stones to have conversations. And I just know I reap the rewards from it. I feel more at peace in myself, happier, and that, as we talked about, that human engagement, you know, or a shared story or understanding, like, it really, really helps, you know.
So what's your advice then, either of you? Maybe start with yourself, Conor. I will give the details of how people can get involved in your specific movement, but you do often hear of mental health issues among men, and you wonder, did they ever reach out, or did anybody know how to say, how are you really, aside from the banter or the talking about sport or whatever else that you've touched on before. So what's your advice among groups of mates, of blokes? How do you start this off?
Well, again, like, I'm not a mental health professional by any means. This is sort of like most of the boys clubs work that I do is sort of part of my own healing process. And so what I would say is kind of just things that have sort of worked for me a little bit, and they might possibly work for other people too. It's just that, with vulnerability, and a little bit like what Al said there, you can go at, I think it's good to go at this with baby steps, you know, and you try sort of talking about things, you know, you don't, and you just try to be a little bit more, maybe you just listen to your friends a little bit more, maybe you kind of, it can be good to actually engage your friend rather than just confessing to your friend. You know what I mean? I think, like, it can be an idea to be, so what's going on with you? Or, you know, pay a little bit more attention to your friend in the same way you'd pay attention to someone you're dating, you know, rather than just take them for granted. Sort of like what's going on in your family at the moment? How are things in your relationship? And I think you'll find that by showing an interest, and that interest, like, is love. You know, by kind of showing this interest and loving your friends, that they'll respond similarly to you. And I think a lot of people, when we consider vulnerability, we just go, oh, I'm going to call up my friend and tell them, like, I'm broken and I'm falling apart here, which is also fine. But as a first step, maybe it can be more useful just to take a bigger interest in them and start to kind of engage them in the conversation that you'd like to be engaged in. And and reach out to the Dublin Boys Club. Do you know what I mean? See what we're doing. And if you feel isolated, just recognize that we all kind of felt isolated too, and that's why we set this thing up.
Well, it sounds like it is the crack. Is there any chance of the girls ever sneaking in, or do we have to stay separate?
not a chance.
All right, then. Well, look, you can find out more information at thedublinboysclub.com. There are plans to move it out along the country, but at the moment, sure, you're meeting on Zoom, anything, so the world is your oyster. And you can also find out more at ateliermazur.com. Al Mazur and Conor Crichton, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks,
Claire.
So that's it for this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, to Simon Keane, and Leisha McKenna was on research, and Jojo Cordoza was on sound. And thank you to you for listening and for making contact. If there's anything you'd like to hear covered from the area of health and wellness, please do drop us an email, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. These are strange times, so let me know what ails you and what might help you. I'll see you next week.